your tears on my pillow that won't dry on their own beyond my ears. I've no sorrow, but today I don't walk alone. Step by step, day by day, day by day, day by day. I'm on the road to recovery, trusting God along the way, trusting God along the way, trusting God all.
Right. Good evening, everybody. We're going to get this underway here. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is John. Thanks for joining us tonight. I know the room's a little set up differently than normal. It's not to throw you off. There's actually a church event for the little ones going on tomorrow for the holidays. So that's why the tables and chairs are like this. We're not as fancy-pantsy as we normally are. So bear with us. However, in a minute or so, we're going to start out the meeting with our two-minute meditation. Fred's going to turn off the lights. Just get situated, if you may. Turn off all devices that make noise. They probably will distract others. We take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the week, day you had drift away. Ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. And we'll start off there. So if you're ready, we'll do the lights and see you on the other side. Do the fog light prayer. If you don't know it, it's right there, and you can repeat after me. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. Amen. There is a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out in which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. So tonight I've asked Art to come up. He's not nervous, but he's going to come up and read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this notice, we read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so we think it's pretty vital to know what it is.
Hi, I'm Art, I'm an alcoholic. Spiritual experience. The term of spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon carefully reading shows that a personality change suppressing to bring about recovery from alcoholism and manifests itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gives many readers the impression that these personality changes are religious experience, but must be in the nature of the certain spectacular, unhavenable happiness for everyone that is concludes on earth and ignores in the first few chapters of the number of sudden revoluntary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire immediately an overwhelming God consciousness for following the once by the visit change of feeling and outlook. Among rapidly growing in the membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations through frequent are by no means rules. Much of our experience are what the psychologist William James called the emotional variety, because they are developed slowly over a period of time. Quite often our friends of the newcomers are aware of the difference long because of himself. He's finally realized that he has undergone a profound alteration in the reaction to life, that such changes could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could solidly have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have trapped in unsuspected resource, which they are possibly identified that their own complications of power are greater than themselves. Most of us think that awareness of power is greater than ourselves. It's ensured that spiritual experience of more religious members call it God consciousness. Most expressly, we wish that they say that any alcoholic capable of honestly feeling his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual components. He can not only defect by the attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one needs to have difficulty with the spiritual program. Willingness, honestness, and open-mindedness are the essentials to recovery, but these are indestructible. There is a principle which bears against the information, which is proof against the argument, that which cannot fail to keep the main in everlasting intolerance, that principal components prior to the investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Thanks, Art. So please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up, sitting back down. Coffee's outside tonight, so that shouldn't be an issue. The restrooms are also over there, so if you need to use those, please do so quietly. This is a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane meeting mode or just turn them off. All right, so tonight I have the privilege of introducing Pat R. He's on his 7th session. We had a break last week due to Thanksgiving, but we're glad to all be back here. The first time I heard Pat speak was in Stuart, Florida, about a year ago, actually. A few of us went up for the Gulf Stream Gratitude Days seminar. I hope I said that right. And he was speaking on the 12th step, and he was literally glowing when he was speaking, and I noticed something in him, and I'm just looking forward to hearing him tonight. So without further ado, Pat.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Pat. Thanks to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the program of AA, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And for that, I'll be forever grateful. AA didn't just give me my life back, but it gave me one worth living. And I have an absolute blast and a passion for recovery. I love it. I absolutely do. I love being here. I love everything about recovery and Alcoholics Anonymous and some other anonymouses that that I visit frequently. But I just love it. As Bill says in Bill Dodson's story, I just can't stop talking about it. I just love talking about it. You know, and I'm glad to see somebody more nervous than me up here. I know the feeling. I'm not supposed to be here. You know, I was that guy. I think I shared with you guys the first week I was here. I was that guy in first grade. I wouldn't get up in front of the class. I mean, I was a guy 6, 7, 8 years old that had his homework done, but if I had to read it, I'm taking the F. I'm not getting up there. You know, that's. I just was afraid of failure. I wouldn't even try for fear of failure. And a lot of my life was like that. So for me to be up here is surely not by my doing. It's truly God-directed. I remember my first meeting, not my first meeting that I read anything. And I'm sorry, but you made me remember it. You know, but I used to hide from How It Works and readings like that. You know, I'd wait. And the Fifth Chapter Club where I got sober was pretty cool because they had a meeting room and then had a club room. And you could, like, hide in the club room to avoid any of those readings until the meeting started and then sneak into the back row at the meetings. And somebody caught me one day and trying to leave the meeting room and handed me How It Works. And I ran into that word constitutionally. I had never seen that word before. You know, I couldn't even pronounce it. I was stumped. Probably one of the most embarrassing moments in my life. I mean, it's up there in the top 10 or 15 for sure. You know, a big group of people, and I don't know the word. And, you know, somebody said, dummy, it's constitutionally. He didn't say dummy, but that's what I heard, you know. I heard dumbass. That's what I heard. I heard somebody say dumbass. It's constitutionally. And I don't know. Who knew? I didn't even know what the word meant after he told me what it meant. I had to go through some steps to figure out what constitutionally was, you know, because I was constitutionally incapable of doing anything, and let alone being honest. So I read something, and it kind of fits right into that, and it has nothing to do with what I'm here to talk about tonight. But one of my biggest fears is public speaking, and so for me to do as much speaking as I do is crazy. I don't know how that happened. I really don't. It just did. You know, somehow it just happened. And so I'm always on my way to these meetings going, what the hell do you do this for? You know, because I got this internal dialogue that starts that makes me think I won't have anything to say or anything to share. My biggest fear is to come up here and just blank, you know, and stand here and have nothing to say and have you people just stare at me being a failure. But I have to read something on social media. Sometimes it's useful. You know, once in a while. And it really described my fear. You know, I used to think, what is it? Is it a lack of faith? Is it lack of knowledge? I mean, you know, what is it that makes you so damn scared to speak? And once I start speaking, it seems like you can't shut me up. I mean, that's part of it. I could probably go on forever. But But it really explained it, and it says this, for those who are deathly afraid of public speaking, which, by the way, most of the world is. It's the biggest fear probably in the world is public speaking. Speaking proceeds under the whips of two tyrants, time and memory. Our memories aren't nearly capacious enough to allow us to compose and pre-compile each sentence before beginning to utter the first syllable. Instead, speaking is like driving with a general sense of the destination, but no clear route planned. We utter the first syllables of a sentence while taking a leap of faith that we'll be able to choose the right words en route to formulate phrases adequately as the words tumble out of our mouths and bring us to an intersection in our thoughts that demands our next move. And that's kind of what I do. I kind of get up here and just start talking about something and hope the next move is God-directed, and hope that God channels through me and takes me down a path that I'm supposed to go down. But it was written by a woman named Julie Sedevi, which I thought really explained the whole deal. And that's really what it is, right? I mean, that's what this is always is about, is a leap of faith. Just a leap of faith that this is God-directed, that I'm not in charge of this deal, and that he will take care of me if I have that faith. And that being said, I think I'm supposed to be talking about step seven. But which when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, or when I first started speaking, and I'd get to these steps, step six and seven, I was going to say, how in the hell can you do an hour on six lines in the sixth step? How the hell are you going to do an hour on step seven? It's seven lines in the big book. He doesn't even give me much information in the book to even work with. And that was true in my early recovery. I used to really struggle with, and I would camouflage that with a lot of stuff. I'd spend like 45 minutes on BS and then hit six and seven. But the longer I'm around here, the more broken I find I am, and that's kind of a dichotomy of recovery, I guess, where I really thought at some point I had overcome my defects. You know, early in recovery, I thought, like, you guys suffer from them defects of character. Well, I've done the steps, and they're, like, behind me, you know. And I kind of had that kind of idea. Like, I used to, like, speak a lot about character defects I used to have. And you guys were all speaking about character defects you had. And I thought, like, you need to do some work. You know, you need to, like, get on the ball and do some writing and some confessing and, you know, get going. And the longer I'm around here, the more broken I really think I am. You know, it just more and more is revealed. And I, after I talk on six, actually, I'm doing two step series, which are kind of in line with each other. And this meeting, it's been on six and seven the last couple of weeks. And the meeting I'm doing up in Pompano is on, I did six and seven last week. And I wonder when I do that six-step talk that I did here the last time, or at the 101 when I did this six- and seven-step talk last week, how many people leave that meeting and go, that guy is sick. Like, that guy works no freaking program whatsoever. Like, you would think after all those years that he's been around here, he'd be a lot better than that. You know? And the truth is, I'm not. The truth is, I'm just not. I'm just one broken individual, one another bozo on this bus trying to become a better person. And it seems as though some of the grosser handicaps that have been exposed through this process have been arrested, but the more subtle ones have become more apparent, and they become more apparent as I go along. And that's really what this whole process has been about, is about exposing that, about exposing what's driving me and what's putting me in conflict with everything and everybody. My problem is that my behavior, as it says in the third step, my behavior has put me in conflict with God, myself, and you. You know, and I can't be in conflict. I can't do conflict. I don't do conflict well. I don't do conflict sober, period. I just don't. You know, I handle it terribly. I'm an emotional cripple. I really am. I, I, I feel pain. I sometimes think I feel pain twice as much as everybody. And I'm talking about emotional pain. Physical pain, I can deal with. Just don't hurt my freaking feelings. That's all. Because if you hurt my feelings, I want to kill myself. But broken finger, no problem. I tape it up. I finish work. I go to the hospital. You know, that's no problem. That's just how I do it. You know, but the physical pain, I can deal with. The emotional pain, and I don't know why I'm such a cripple to it, but I mask that emotional pain with the instincts, with the social instinct, the security instinct, and the sex instinct. I act out in those areas to mask what's going on inside of me. It's like a drug. It's absolutely like a drug. But when you hurt my feelings, I need to medicate. And so I needed something. I needed a path to living without conflict in my life, which is impossible, right? I mean, really, that's a fantasy to be without conflict. It's just, we're always going to be in conflict with someone or something somewhere. You know, it's impossible not to be. But how am I going to deal with the conflict? And this whole journey so far, I mean, seventh step, which I'm supposed to be talking about, really refers to humility for the first time. I mean, we hear the word brought up, especially in the fifth step, humbling, humility, and humbling. But the seventh step really starts to talk about humility, especially in the 12 and 12. It's all about humility. But we know that humility is the underlying principle behind all the steps. You know, when we talk about step 7, we talk about humility mostly. You know, the principle behind humility, and by the way, that's not something Bill wrote. That's just something some AA member wrote, those principles behind the steps. And they're cool. I like them, you know. But humility is talked about in 7. But when you really look at all the steps, it's been all about humility, hasn't it? It's been and my definition that I've come to love of in humility comes to me from the 12 and 12 in the step 5, where it talks about knowing exactly, I'm paraphrasing, knowing exactly who and what we are, knowing exactly who and what I am and what I can become with these principles in my life, with God in my life, right? And that to me is what humility is. And this whole journey has been about exposing who and what I am. You know, I mean, how much humility was there in step 1 to realize that I'm an alcoholic? I mean, I really didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't look like your typical alcoholic. I mean, I was a drunk. I mean, I was early wet brain when I got here, but I still had a job. I still had a house. I still drove a decent car. You know, I always made it to work. I had terrific willpower when it came to work ethics. I just lacked willpower when it came to controlling or stopping my drinking. Now, the flip side of that is I look good on the outside. I had been through 2 marriages. You know, I can't tell you how many jail cells I've landed in. You know, I lost custody of my son, and I've given up my freedom multiple times because I couldn't stay stopped or I couldn't control my drinking. So there was this yin and yang in my life. On the outside, my mother couldn't believe it when I entered AA. How could you be an alcoholic? You're not an alcoholic. And my ex-wife is, I've been telling you all along, you know. So how much humility does it take to make that walk of shame, right? That white chip walk, you know. And I'm talking about the people who realize they're an alcoholic and make that walk. Not somebody that's making that walk because they want to phase up. Or because their peers told them, get up and get a chip, you're new, you know. Somebody who really knew what it meant to get up and pick up that white chip, you know. This idea of the inability to stay stopped because of this obsession of mind and this inability to control it because of this physical craving that develops once we put a drink or a drug in our system. That's knowing exactly who and what I am. I'm an alcoholic. What does that mean? I can't stay stopped and I can't control it. That's what it means. 2 things. That's it. It has nothing to do with people, places, and things. It disturbs people, places, and things. But it has nothing to do with it. That's not why I drink. That's not why I can't stay stopped. You know, it's not why I can't control it. And to admit that I got nothing, right? The first 2 steps. I can't stay stopped and my willpower is insufficient. That's humility. That's knowing who and what I am. I can't. Void of a spiritual experience, void of some kind of spiritual intervention, I am doomed. That's knowing exactly who and I am. And that's the first 2 steps. You know, we can't give you those. We can give you the information there, but we can't give you those steps. That's 2 conclusions. There's no work there. The work there is done outside of here. I often laugh when I hear, but what step are you on? I'm on step one. Really? You're still drinking? You know? I mean, that's what that means to me. You know? You're still getting high? Step one's done out there. I'll tell you what it means to be powerless, but you got to get powerless on your own. I can't get that for you. And that's the two, you know, I've said this a few times in here. Those are the two requirements to have this spiritual awakening, this spiritual experience, this personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism that we talk about. Those are the two requirements, to admit that you're powerless and admit that you got nothing against it. You got no weapon to prevent you from picking up a drink again. The fact is we've lost the power of choice in drink. I am without defense against the first drink. I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the pain and suffering of this morning. He says a week or a month ago in the book, this morning I couldn't. I couldn't bring that because emotionally I'm a cripple. Because emotionally I can't stand the way I feel. I'm in conflict. I'm in conflict with myself most of the time. And at some point I can't stand the way I feel. And I can't stand it so much that I forget what alcohol is going to do to me or the consequences attached to it in favor of what it's going to do for me, and it's going to fix that. We know that. That's going to be imprinted onto my brain for the rest of my life. I still remember my first drink. I still remember standing outside that gymnasium with a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, and I got halfway through that bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, and the planets freaking aligned. You know, the stars all got brighter. I got taller, stronger, better looking, and I learned how to dance. I did my John Travolta staying alive thing on the dance floor that night. I'm going to have to probably change that story. How many even knows who John Travolta is? You know, so good. Just a couple of you. Jeez, I'm getting old. Bruno Mars. I did my best Bruno Mars. I'm going to change this story somewhere. I'll never forget that night. Never. That moment was perfect. Perfect. I'm telling you, it was perfect. And I don't care what was it. I don't care that I got sick afterwards. I don't care that I was hungover the next day. I don't care that I slept most of the next day and didn't go to work. I don't care about all that. That moment was perfect. And I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. And when the conflict hits, When the emotional pain hits, man, I reach back to that moment, yeah, or moments just like it. And I know that there's relief there temporarily. I have no defense. And to turn that over, to make the decision to seek that solution, the only solution I have left. And we have to be convinced of that, right? I mean, in, before step three, it has the ABCs, right? We have to be convinced. It says being convinced. Right, being convinced of the first two steps. You got to be convinced. I stop. When I'm sponsoring guys, we stop right there. Are you convinced? If you're not, let's not move on. There's no reason to. That's moving somebody faster than they want to move. They're not ready to move. You convinced you're an alcoholic? Are you convinced that no human power, no girlfriend, child, judge is going to keep you sober? Are you convinced that God could and would if you were sought? That's the decision. And if you're not, then we're not moving on. But there's some humility attached there. That's a surrender. That's a surrender. White flag. I got nothing. My strongest weapon is putting my mind to it, and I can't say it stopped. I've said, how many times have we said that? I mean it this time. I'm going to put my mind to it this time. I remember in Pittsburgh, I'm moving to Florida. How the hell did I know the cocaine cowboys were down here? I didn't know. Who knew? Took it to a whole new level. My drinking cut back a little. Shit, I found a way to drink around the clock. Still make it to work. I always think about that. It cost me $300 to go to work to make 80. Yeah. I was a good employee, though, boy. Fastest dude in that floor, man. Look at that son of a bitch go. Jesus, we need 10 of him, you know. But The fourth step and the fifth step, I mean, the third step exposed our problem, right? I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity. And I push against you, I butt my head against yours, I demand attention, and I demand material goods, and I demand romance from you. And you push back. And I'm in conflict with the world trying to satisfy those instinctual drives, you know. Instinctual drives that are like a drug. And that's what was exposed in 4 and 5. That's what got exposed. 6 and 7 got exposed. 6 got exposed in 4 or 5. There's my handicaps. That's what's keeping me in conflict with you. My demand for attention, my demand for money, not just money, more money, more attention, more money, more attention, more money, sex, more sex, different sex, sex with different people. Just never enough of any of it. And I'm in conflict. It's me putting myself in conflict. It's not the rest of the world. It's how I react to the rest of the world, or it's what I bring to the rest of the world that's put me in conflict. But if I don't overcome that conflict, I can't stay sober. I just can't. I was at a memorial for a guy, Dennis O, last night, who was, you'd had to have been around here for a while to know Dennis, has had 52 years when he passed, and he was probably one of the most influential people in my life early in recovery. He was one of those guys that I followed around. You know, I followed him around. I followed Ben T around. I followed my old sponsor, Garrett M, around. You know, I followed the guys that I wanted what they had. I followed those guys around. Father Bob Hanlon, I followed him around. You know, and I latched on to those guys and followed him. And Dennis used to say stuff. Dennis is a guy who taught me how to surrender. And I don't know what he knew. I didn't know at the time what he knew, but I know now what he knew. And we would always have these conversations about surrender, you know. And it wasn't about surrender my alcoholism. It was about surrendering my instinctual drives. It was about surrendering a house or surrendering money or surrendering a car, you know. And he would ask me questions, you know. And this is the way, if anybody knew Dennis, this is the way he would always greet you. He'd say, "Hey, wise guy, how's your way working today?" You know? And I thought, "Oh, Dennis, man, you know, it looks like I'm going to lose the house. You know, she's taking the house. The bitch is taking the house. You know, that's everything I am is in that house." And he says, "You should give her the house." And I said, "What's wrong with you, Dennis? You know, I worked all my life to get that house." And he says, "Well, doesn't she need a place to live?" "Well, that's beside the point, Dennis." He said, "What about your children? You know, don't they need a place to live? So you're going to ask your children to move out of their bedrooms? What kind of man are you? Give her the house." "I don't know, Dennis. I don't know." He says, "You're going to lose that house." I'm thinking, what the hell do you know? You know, you don't know who I am. I said, "Well, you know what? It's bad enough I got to give her the car." He said, "Well, you should give her the car." "No, no, it's my car, Dennis. The car's in my name. It's my car." "Yeah, give her the car. You should give her the car." Yeah. What the hell's wrong with these guys, you know? They're not giving me any advice that I want to hear, right? He says, "You got an attorney?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You should fire him." What the hell are you talking about, you know? No idea what he meant. I saw him about a month later. He says, "How's that house thing?" I said, "I don't even want that house anymore, Dennis." I said, "What do I need a 4-2 with a pool for? I'm by myself. I think I'm just going to let her have the house." You know, he says, "You'll probably keep it." "Yeah. How about that car?" I said, "Nah, I don't need it. I got the truck. I got the work truck. It's good enough." "Yeah. How about the attorney?" I said, "I got rid of my attorney." You know, I didn't know that you could surrender and win. That was just nothing. That was a foreign concept to somebody like me who walked in here, who fought for everything, who left claw marks in everything that I let go of. Yeah. You know, I'm still in that house today. That was 1991. I'm still in that house. She didn't want the house. She only wanted it because I wanted it. She couldn't afford the house. You know what happened when I got rid of my attorney? She got rid of hers. And we sat down and we worked on a divorce agreement. You know, rather than let the attorneys make all kind of money. I don't know how Dennis knew that stuff, you know. But Dennis used to, I don't even know where I went off on that tangent. Dennis used to say stuff about following rules, that you got to follow the rules, tough guy. You know, got to follow some rules. You want to feel good? I said, yeah. He said, do something good. I mean, isn't it that simple? Right? Isn't it 6 and 7 really that simple? Right? Stop being dishonest and start being honest. Stop being inconsiderate and start being considerate. Stop being selfish and start being unselfish. You want to feel good? Do something good for somebody. Oh, low self-esteem. You have low self-esteem? Why don't you try doing something esteemable? That's what he would say. Do something esteemable. You'll get self-esteem. Yeah. So I think, you know, in my mind, everything has led here. And I'll say it again. Everything's going to lead back here. You know, we're going to have a break here. We're going to gain some credibility. We're going to start showing up differently, and then we're going to make some amends because we show up differently in 6 and 7. But then we're in 10, 11, and 12, especially in 10 and 11, it's about keeping these instincts in check. You know, I've exposed my grosser handicaps. I've exposed all my handicaps. The grosser handicaps start to fall away, right? The ones that are blatant, the ones that you see, I start to fall away. Like, I no longer do B&Es anymore, right? We don't rob, we don't steal cars anymore. We don't do any of that, right? I don't cheat on my wife anymore, right? I try not to blatantly lie, right? I try. I've seen what puts me in conflict. I see that it's me that puts you in conflict. So some of the grosser handicaps, but the more subtle ones retreat within me, and there's this constant spiritual warfare that goes on in my mind on whether to do the right thing or not. And you would think that would be so cut and dry, but I can play this justification game in my head. There's this dark and this light that battles in my head, and it starts, the stuff starts to retreat, you know? So we've gained a sense of humility in all these first 5 steps and the 6 steps, and we've gained a sense of knowing exactly who and what we are now. I'm powerless, and I'm selfish and self-centered, and it's me putting myself in conflict with God, myself, and you, that the three relationships, the only relationships that matter, all my relationships I'm in conflict with, and I need to bring these to a point that's acceptable to God and you, right? I need to bring these character defects to a point where it's acceptable to society, which is, unfortunately, society dictates what's acceptable and what's not. And what's acceptable to God? I got to start practicing some damn principles in my life. But it becomes an internal conflict now. It's not an external conflict. And I think 7 speaks to that. 7 speaks to, and that's why I seem to be, the longer I'm around here, the more broken I seem, you know, because there's these more subtle defects of character that are internal that you don't see. And they only come to light in the privacy of my own home, or they only come to light in the privacy of my own vehicle. Or they only come to light when it's me and a customer and nobody else is around but me and that customer. Yeah. You know, that pride, you know, that Bill speaks to in 5, he also speaks to the 7 deadly sins, you know. And those are the ones that are more subtle. We got these cardinal defects that we deal with in step 4, this you know, dishonesty and this selfishness and this inconsideration and this, you know, fear that we drive ourselves with. But there's the more subtle ones, right? The pride, the anger, the greed, the gluttony, the lust, the envy, the sloth. You know, he starts to speak to some more subtle character defects. So the road starts to narrow, right? As we stay around here, the road starts to narrow. And at the beginning, I'm like really thrilled that I'm no longer a blatant liar, cheat, and thief. And so the rest of my character defects seem okay because the more blatant, the grosser handicaps I'm working on. And I don't even notice the rest of them. until those ones come under arrest, until those ones I start getting them down, and I stop acting out on those grosser handicaps, and then the more subtle ones start to bother me. Right? And it's funny, I think sometimes, I think Pete and I were talking about this briefly before the meeting, sometimes we get complacent, right? We the further we get away from the drink and the drug, the less the pull to the drink and the drug, and we almost feel like we can get away with more. There's like, it's almost like it's no big deal. I'm not going to drink over it. Yeah. But it puts me in conflict. And if you're the alcoholic like me, and the people who relate to me is, I don't do conflict. I don't do it well. Conflict just blows me away. It takes me out of my whole day. It consumes me. I've shared with you guys, I think last time I was here, you know, just subtle stuff that my wife will say that will just blow me away. You know, just the fact that she doesn't like the way I dress or something. What the hell? Why would you hurt my feelings like that? I mean, you know, a normal person would just let that go. Right? 2 days later, I'm thinking about a divorce. It's a cripple. So, you know, the pride, this either I feel superior or I feel less than. There just doesn't seem to be this happy medium there. I always thought pride was a good thing when I got here, but it's not. It's either a feeling of superiority or a feeling of being less than everybody else, you know. And I'm always stuck in one of those categories. You know, I explained to you, I'm the best at what I do at work. I'm just damn. That's just a fact. I'm the best at what I do. You know, and as soon as I make that statement, I screw up. You know, as soon as I make that statement, something goes wrong. Or I look at myself, and or I have this inner dialogue that tells me I'm a piece of shit. Yeah. And you're worthless, and you don't look. You know, you need to look like him, or you need to be taller, or your ears need to be smaller. All my life, I looked in the mirror and hated what I saw in the mirror. I look back at some of my childhood photos. I was not an ugly kid. I thought I was a troll. I really did. I mean, hated my hair. I hated my nose. I hated everything. You know, I had this Italian nose and this frizzy-ass hair. And, you know, I just hated who I was. You know, I look back, I go, boy, I wasn't a bad-looking kid. You know? What gives us that? What gives us that inner dialogue? What presents that? How do we get there? How do we get there? But I like to feel superior, you know. And what it turns into, the more subtle, you know, the more subtle defect is the gossip. Start to take people's inventories, right? It kills people. It absolutely kills people. But I fell into that trap early in recovery. Start taking people's inventory, right? You start criticizing the speaker. That speaker sucked, you know. That speaker, he's terrible up there. What a drunkalog that was. Jesus, did he ever get sober? Jesus, you know. And you sit around a table and literally character assassinate somebody that comes up here scared to death like every one of us that gets up here does the very best that they possibly can because nobody else will get up there and do it, and then they get criticized for it. You'll never hear me talk about it. Once I started speaking and I realized the fear that was involved in speaking, I don't criticize anybody. I give you all the credit in the world to come up here and read how it works, you know, because I blew it on how it works early on. You know? Literally kills people. Gossip literally kills people here. Why didn't I want to do a fifth step with you guys? I sat at Denny's with you guys and talked about everybody. Right? I knew for a fact if I did my fifth step with one of you guys, it was going to be at Denny's. Right? That's how deadly it is, right? That's how deadly. I was afraid to do my fifth step with you because I sat around and gossiped with you. A little more subtle defect, right? What do we justify it, though, right? Oh, no, I mean well. You know, it's just to help him out, right? Stating the obvious, that's all. We justify gossip and mask it with we're trying to help them by telling them the truth, you know? Such a crock. You know, I'm not blatantly rageful anymore. I'm not that. Oh, I used to just lose it, man. Just lose it. I'm telling you, I haven't lost it in sobriety. I've, you know, the demon has come out a few times over little shit, over little stuff. You know, I'll never forget, we were getting ready to go to Disney and packing up the car, go to Disney World, and it was raining out, and I had my new, brand new, fully loaded 1988 Tempo. I told you about that car, didn't I? That salesman said, I'm selling this guy that Tempo tonight. We're going to get rid of that Tempo tonight. Because you know, who the hell would buy a fully loaded Tempo, you know? Nobody. Right? I got everybody in the car, and the dog runs out of the house, which I told them to keep in the house. Keep the dog in the house. The dog's not going. Leave the dog in the house. I made it clear the dog stays in the house because it's muddy out. The dog come out of the house, ran through the mud, through the back seat, through the front seat, and back into the mud, and just left mud all over the damn inside of the car. I freaking lost it. Lost it. I don't even know where that came from. He's back. I mean, that's what my kids were sitting there, and my wife at the time was sitting there and went, oh, my God. We remember these days. Sober, stone cold sober. Those defects seem to have gone away, but privately and internally, boy, I drive a lot. I drive about 150 miles a day, right? I go from job to job all day long. I don't know how half of you guys got a driver's license. I want to tell you that too. You know, I want to come out, I want to tell you, like, how could somebody so stupid get a driver's license, you know? My biggest pet peeve is stopping on the on-ramp, you know? We're going to merge into a 70-mile-an-hour traffic, but we need to stop on the damn on-ramp. I'm there tonight, and I'm on my way to speak, so I'm trying to be cool, because it could be somebody who's sitting here when I get here. That's the scariest thing in the life, right? You give somebody the finger, and then they're sitting at the table when you get that'd be bad, right? You got to represent. He's speaking about spiritual principles. That dude just flipped me off on the way over here. Happens. But, you know, nobody sees that side of me. Nobody sees that side in the car. Son of a bitch. Yeah. Now, I don't get out of the car anymore. Progress. I haven't been in a fist fight since I got sober. Come close, but I haven't been in one. If you have never come close, you haven't been to many business meetings. I was in CVS with my wife recently, and this guy, he's pulling into CVS, and I'm pulling in. We're like heading each other, and I always back my truck in. I'm not sure why. Because trucks back in. That's what the deal is. We have trucks, we back in, you know? And I'm used to it because my van has no sight lines, so you can't see, but I'm used to backing in. So I swing out, and he's ready to take the spot, and I back into the spot that he's going to take, right? And he's pissed. He is pissed. The older guy, I see the MF and the CS is coming out of his mouth. He's fuming inside that car. And the windows are up, so I can't hear what he's saying, right? But he's pissed. And my wife's with me, so I don't want to be an ass, you know? So I get out of the truck, and I walk real slow because I want him to get out at the same time. And we do. We meet, and I go, were you talking to me? Very nicely. And he just stared at me, and he didn't say anything. And we went into CVS, and I got my shopping cart, and I stalked him all through CVS the whole time he was there. My wife was shopping, and I was pushing the cart. I showed up in every aisle he was in. Where does that come from, you know? I didn't want to kick his ass, but I wanted to disturb him, you know? More subtle, and I'm laughing about it. He's not, you know. And my wife's going, kick your ass over here. Jesus, stop it. You know, stop harassing the guy. Hey, it's a process. But we didn't fight. It just become more subtle, right? I'm not greedy to the point where I'm a thief, but I'm driven by the security instinct, you know. When I come up against doing the right thing sometimes, which is going to cost me to lose money, or take the money. It becomes some spiritual warfare going on right there. I do the right thing normally. You know, I think I said it last week, you know, if I find the $20 bill on the floor, I'm going to ask whose 20 it is, because I'm honest Pat. You know, you want the 20, here's the 20, it's your 20, whose 20 is it? You know, come on, I got to find it, I'll leave the 20 here until somebody come up and claim it. But what about the Bank of America bag that falls off the truck that's got 100 grand in it, you know, unmarked bills? I don't know what's going to happen that day, you know. I think I'm going to give it back. Yeah, I'm going to give it back. I'm going to say that I'm going to give it back. But there'll be a struggle. But can you live with that? See, I know I can't live with that. I know I can't live with that cloud. I know I can't live in that conflict with myself. You know, is somebody going to know? It's the wrong thing to do. Where's my relationship with God? My sobriety is contingent on my relationship with God and with you and with myself. It's in all three areas of my life, all three dimensions of my life have to be in check. Or I'm in conflict, and I need to treat the conflict. And I'll treat it in other ways first, whether it be a sex spree or a spending spree or buy another car, buy another truck, something bigger, something better, something to change the way I feel for the moment. But I can't afford those dark clouds following me around. I can't afford, you know, the lust issues, the driving force of the sex instincts. You know, this idea that I know that's a bell that I can't ring. You know, Bill talks about it in step 4, one of my favorite paragraphs in the book, is suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does that mean we're going to get drunk? Not necessarily. If we know what we did wrong and we want to ask God to take us to better things, we'll probably be all right. But if we continue that behavior, we're sure going to drink. This is a fact out of our experience, you know. When I talk about falling short, you can't ring bells that you can't unring. Cheating, you can't unring. You just can't unring that bell. That doesn't go away. That does permanent damage. You know, whether they forgive you or not, they don't forget. You know, that's a violation that you just can't ring that bell. You know, so I don't ring that bell, and I know that my sobriety is contingent on that. I know that I can't ring that bell. But there becomes this other internal dialogue. There become these more subtle areas where we act out, whether it be on porn, wherever we take the instinct, whether it be just lusting, whether it be able just flirting because we like the attention, because I like the attention. Yeah. Just need that validation. Just need that. I desperately need validation. Yeah. It's getting better. Used to demand it all the time. Right? Get on Facebook, tell her you love her. She doesn't respond. 20 minutes go by, she doesn't respond. She could at least like my post. I know she's on, I see the green dot. She liked that guy's post over there. Maybe she's seeing him. Craziness that goes on internally. You know, I want to hear, you got to tell me you love me at 10, tell me you love me at noon again, tell me at 2, tell me at 4, tell me when you get home. You know, just driven by these instinctual drives for validation. I got to have validation. They become more subtle. Here's when I know I'm on the right track. When I'm the only one offended. I'm the only one offended by my own behavior. Nobody else even knows. It's my own private conversations. It's in the privacy of my own home. It's when I'm alone that I'm disturbed by my own thoughts. Did you ever say that to yourself? I can't believe I thought that. Oh, I say it all the time. Can't believe I went there. Unfortunately, I go there in thought, and then I ask God to take me to better things. And that's really the theme behind step 7, isn't it? Is that I am powerless over those instinctual drives. God-given, good, but I've taken them to extremes because they're pleasurable. And the only way I can bring those instincts in line with what God's will was for them to be and where they're not in conflict with you is to have God's help. I'm powerless over it. What's it say in the third step? There seems no way to overcome this selfishness and self-centeredness. We must have God's help or it kills us. There it is. The instinctual drives will kill us unless we bring them in line with where God intended them to be. I'm obviously speaking for myself. You know, I am offended by my own thoughts. You know, and that's a good thing for me. You know, because if I wasn't, I'd probably act out on it. So I'm finding a moral compass as I go along here, you know, that's acceptable to me. And we're not dictating morality here. You know, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not judging your sex life. I'm not judging you at all. Every single one of us knows that we know that we know. You know, the book talks about the God within. And I believe that, that we've got this God within us. And this is about removing what's blocking us from the God within us. Conscience, soul, common sense, call it whatever you want. If there was no sense of spirituality in your life, you wouldn't feel guilt, remorse, or shame when you'd step on people's toes. You wouldn't feel bad. It's on you. How does it sit with you? How does it sit with me? Yeah. And I know when something doesn't sit with me. The soul tells me, my conscience tells me when it's not in line with God's will. Yeah. I have that moral compass that keeps me in line. Yeah. You know, the seven-step prayer is a third-step prayer over again. It's just different words. You know, God, I offer myself to thee. God, take all of me, good and bad. You know, it's the same prayer. The only difference is there's an amen after the seven-step prayer. No amen after the third-step prayer because nothing's changed. Nothing's changed in step three. We've made a decision to change, but nothing's changed. Hopefully, theoretically, in step seven, something has changed. The traveler has changed. Amen. Thanks for letting me be here tonight. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thank you, Upper. Mm-hmm. We're going to thank this speaker again. And here is Stephanie for the secretary report.
Hi, my name is Stephanie, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary.
Hey, Stephanie.
In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I have asked Debbie to please come up and read the recovered statement. We read this statement to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, I'm Debbie. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Debbie.
Hi. We are not cured of alcoholism, recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for a lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
...1940s style big book sponsorship from forward to second edition Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. May I please see a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? And is there anyone in need of a sponsor tonight? Could you please raise your hand? Please stand up, ladies. Recovered alcoholics, let's get these folks back to God. Tonight is the last meeting of the month, which means we celebrate anyone who has a year or more of sobriety this past 30 days. So would anybody celebrating in the month of November like to stand up? And can you please tell us your name and how many years of sobriety?
2 years.
Okay, so announcements, the AA's Got Talent show will be February 3rd, which is a Saturday. They are still looking for talent and volunteers. You can find flyers in the back. Also, next Thursday, the 7th, there will be no meeting. There is a church event, so please feel free to use a meeting guide to find somewhere else to go to that night. Also, feel free to join us on Monday nights for the Big Book Study meeting where the book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30 and the Big Book Study starts at 7:15. We have CDs, mugs, large print big books, the Little Red Book, and Big Book Dictionaries for sale in the back. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. We'll see you next week.
Yeah, we'll see you on Monday because we don't have the Thursday next week, unfortunately, like Stephanie said. But Monday, I believe we're across the street. We're going to be in the church across the street. It's a small building towards the left. We'll all be there to guide you, but join us for our big book study. So tonight's session and all the past speaker podcasts are online for free at alcoholicsandgod.org if you want to check those out. I highly recommend that. I just invited you to our Monday night big book study. If you're going to thank Pat tonight, we don't really have a center aisle. We're kind of all over the place, but we'll try to stay somewhat organized in thanking our speaker. Last announcement is our smoking. No smoking and vape zone in front of the door. So when you get out, if you don't mind, go to the left. We have buckets over there. You'll see those. So please don't light up when you get right out. It's a 75-foot no smoke vape zone. All right. So we're going to close with the Lord's Prayer in our seats. Our Father.
Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks, guys. Can I see you Monday?
Profit me anything in the end. Zan, oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby, baby. Yes, when you're laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby. And I hope
thank you. Whoa!